Bill. I'm the U.S. Chair of OMFIT. Today, I have the great pleasure of welcoming Bill Dudley. Bill was chief economist at Goldman Sachs for a decade before joining the New York Fed in 2007 as head of the Markets Group, which, as you all know, conducts U.S. open market operations. In 2009, with Tim Geithner's ascendance to the Treasury throne, Bill became president of the New York Fed, where he served till 2018. He's now affiliated with Princeton University. And of course, he's such a towering figure in the history of U.S. monetary policy, he probably needs no introduction. Welcome, Bill. Thanks for joining us today.
And thank you, Mark. In terms of the economic outlook, it's pretty obvious we're going to see a bounce in economic activity in the third quarter. There has been considerable opening up in the United States. People are less stringent in terms of the degree of social distancing. But how high and how long this bounce will last, I think, is highly uncertain. And anybody who tells you that they understand what the nature of the U.S. economic trajectory, I think, is not telling the truth. A lot of uncertainty about, first, the course of the pandemic itself. That depends a little bit on how people behave. It also depends on whether a vaccine can be developed in a timely way. There's also a lot of uncertainty about fiscal policy. If you look at the three major pieces of fiscal policy support to date, the Paycheck Protection Program, the large increase in unemployment compensation benefits, and the checks that were sent to households, all those three major pieces of fiscal policy are either one time or they end at the end of July. So there's a big fiscal cliff that's happening at the end of July. So if fiscal policy is not forthcoming over the next couple months, new fiscal policy, that's going to be a pretty damaging blow to the U.S. economy. Also, on the fiscal policy side, there's some sizable gaps. While there was a lot of support to households and businesses, the support to state and local governments was very, very modest. And state and local governments in the United States have to run balanced budgets. And so the shortfall in revenue is going to start to lead to stringency in budgets and job layoffs. So you're going to actually start to see the state and local government sector start to be a constraint on economic activity. Second reason why I think there is a lot of uncertainty about the economic outlook is the just slowdown that we've had has been quite sizable. You know, real GDP in the second quarter, which we'll get at the end of July, it's probably going to show an annualized rate of decline of 40, 50, 60%, something on that order of magnitude. And that is causing significant damages to business and household balance sheets. Now, the fiscal policy stimulus, we can repair some of that, but not all of that. If you look at the Fed's summary of economic projections, I think their forecast provides, I think, a reasonable benchmark of what might happen. They see an economic recovery taking place in the second half of 2020 into 2021, but the unemployment rate still stays very high for quite a long time. So at the end, the fourth quarter of this year, the Fed's central tendency projection is an unemployment rate of still 9 to 10%. And the unemployment rate doesn't get down to full employment in the time frame of their projections, which extend out through 2022. So what does this all mean for the Fed? Well, first is we know that policy is going to stay extraordinarily accommodative for the foreseeable future. Short-term rates will stay near zero. The large-scale asset purchases that the Fed embarked on are going to continue. They're buying $85 billion of treasuries every month and $40 billion of agency securities every month. So the balance sheet is going to be growing quite rapidly. In the last couple of weeks, the balance sheet's actually fallen, but it's all just because of the foreign exchange swap programs. If you remember, the foreign exchange swap auctions were 84-day auctions. The first 84-day auctions expired 2 weeks ago, the last week, the second one. Because market function in the foreign exchange markets has recovered, those foreign exchange swaps outstanding are coming down very, very sharply now. And that temporarily is causing the balance sheet to shrink. Not going to last for very long, and that's very modest relative to what the Fed's doing in terms of their asset purchase programs. Also, the liquidity support programs that the Fed has announced for the corporate sector, the municipal sector, support to medium-sized business through the Main Street Lending Program, those are all just starting to get geared up. So I think it's pretty obvious that you'll see a pretty significant expansion of the balance sheet as we get from here to the end of the year. Balance sheet today is about $7 trillion for the Fed, up about $3 trillion so far. And we'll probably get to $9 trillion or so by the end of the year, depending on how fast the Fed can actually ramp up these special liquidity facilities. Fed's also going to be considering other steps. The first thing that they're thinking very hard about is forward guidance. So forward guidance is basically telling the markets how long the Fed expects to keep short-term interest rates low. So far, they haven't rushed into providing significant forward guidance because they're uncertain about the economic outlook and because market expectations are pretty well aligned with the Federal Reserve. You look at the Eurodollar futures market, and you look out 5 years, Eurodollar future yields are still below 1%. So the market is basically saying, we don't think the Fed's going to raise rates for a long time. The Fed, in the summary of economic projections, is saying we don't expect to raise rates for a long time. So there's no disconnect between the market expectations and the Fed. So that means that for guidance, you know, there's no rush to do that. And I think the uncertainty about the outlook is causing the Fed to slow down a little bit in announcing its forward guidance, because I think it basically wants to have a stronger view about how things are likely to unfold. I would guess that forward guidance will be forthcoming at some point, and the Fed will probably tie that forward guidance to economic conditions. So I can imagine forward guidance that looks sort of like this. We're not going to tighten monetary policy until the unemployment rate falls below 5% and inflation climbs above 2%. I mean, obviously, they could pick slightly different numbers than that, but something on that order of magnitude. And that would cause people to say, well, gee, it's going to be a very long time before we get unemployment below 5% and inflation below 2%. And so that would anchor short-term rate expectations. Second thing the Fed's been talking a lot about is yield curve control. So this is the idea of pegging medium-term and longer-term treasury yields at a particular level, sort of like what's happened in the Bank of Japan. But the Fed has been quite cautious about proceeding here, because while they understand how yield curve control can be implemented, it's pretty easy to implement it, they're concerned about how you actually exit. So I think that very unlikely that the Fed will embark in yield curve control beyond 2 or 3 years. I can imagine a situation where the Fed could basically say, for all Treasury obligations out till June of 2023, we're going to keep those yields below 40 basis points. And they might do that because that would reinforce forward guidance. That would basically make it clear that the Fed does actually expect to keep rates low for 3 years. The advantage of doing yield curve control would also reduce the need to actually buy assets. If you have a credibility on yield curve control, you actually don't really actually have to buy as many assets, because the market basically knows you're there to buy them if yields start to drift up. So I think yield curve control is possible, but it's not going to be pegging the 10-year Treasury note or going further out the yield curve. It's probably 2 to 3 years out, and just to reinforce the Fed forward guidance. Third thing that people ask a lot about is, will the Fed move to negative short-term rates? Not going to happen in the United States. A number of reasons why the Fed is not going to pursue that. First, there's not much room created by going to negative short-term rates, because you can only go maybe 75 basis points negative before people start to hoard cash. Second, they don't want to move to negative rates because that will destroy the functioning of U.S. money markets, which have some value. Third, negative rates harm bank profitability by constraining the net interest margin, and that is important because that can potentially hurt credit availability. And the fact that the Fed has been so negative on negative interest rates also makes it more unlikely that they'll ever go there, because it's hard to sell a movement of negative interest rates as a positive development if you told people that you're very reluctant to do that. Whenever the Fed embarks in a new policy, they always want people to feel that this new policy that we're doing should make you feel more optimistic about the outlook. Well, if the Fed tomorrow said we're moving to negative interest rates, I think the markets would actually react quite negatively, because they'd say, gee, boy, the Fed must be really worried about the economic outlook. So negative interest rates in the United States, at least, I just don't think are going to happen. I think the Fed has a lot of challenges. A lot of them are about communication. The first challenge the Fed has is that while monetary policy can do a lot of things, the Fed is not as powerful as people think. So there's room for disappointment. The Fed can take steps to improve market function. The Fed can take steps to make financial conditions more accommodative. But the Fed cannot repair balance sheets that are damaged by weak economic activity. And they can't fill the income hole created by this shortfall of economic activity. And I think it's important for the Fed to be clear about what they can do and what they can't do. Otherwise, there's going to be room for disappointment. The second thing is that what they're doing to support financial markets has boosted financial asset prices, and that exacerbates inequality. And that's particularly germane in the current environment, where the coronavirus really disproportionately hurts less advantaged people in terms of their exposure to the pandemic, to their effects on their income, and the Fed's actions by supporting the stock market and supporting the high-yield debt market. That exacerbates inequality, and that creates a challenge for the Fed to explain that they're doing this not because they're trying to create greater inequality. They're doing this to basically ease financial conditions to support the economy as best they can. And the third challenge the Fed has is that they're coming to the rescue and bailing out people who you could arguably say had engaged in bad behavior. So you think about the hedge funds that bought lots of cash treasuries and shorted treasury futures, highly leveraged. They got caught in the market in March. The Fed came in and bought lots of treasuries and essentially bailed them out. The Fed's also bailing out people in the high-yield debt market by supporting high-yield debt. And so that behavior, you know, creates this sort of notion that the Fed is there for Wall Street, but not so much for Main Street. So I think the Fed does have some significant challenges in terms of explaining, you know, why it's doing what it's doing, explaining why its tools are limited and there's only so much it can do. And that life's about alternatives. You know, if the choice was no recovery and greater equality, or recovery and greater inequality, the Fed is likely to pick recovery and greater inequality, because generating an economic recovery does benefit the country broadly.
You basically suggested that, as is known, monetary policy is less effective around the zero bound, and you've gone through a range of options, and you've suggested that they can be of limited impact. So even though monetary policy is your specialty, what can you tell us about how you think about the fiscal monetary mix going forward?
Well, right now, I don't think there's a conflict between the goals of the fiscal authorities and the goals of the monetary policy authorities, because the economy is so far below full employment and we're in a disinflationary environment. So both sides want to see an economy that grows faster and see a decline in unemployment. But one can imagine a conflict that could develop a few years down the road if the economy actually gets back towards full employment and the Fed wants to start to raise interest rates. The consequences of that in terms of fiscal policy, interest on the accumulated debt, that will start to become very significant at some point. So I think that there could be a conflict between fiscal and monetary policy down the road, where the fiscal authorities might be unhappy when the Fed ultimately has to raise short-term interest rates. But that's years off at this point, and I don't really see a big conflict at the current time. And I think, if anything, I think the Fed would like to see more fiscal policy stimulus right now. I think the Fed would like to see Congress come back with aid to state and local governments, probably some extension of unemployment compensation benefits, because I think they're worried about the very sharp fiscal contraction that we're going to see after July if there's nothing more forthcoming from Congress.
In your challenges ahead, and maybe this is too future-oriented, but you just alluded to it, do you worry about Fed independence? Do you see fiscal dominance creating a problem down the road that could compromise the Federal Reserve as you know and love it?
Well, right now, I don't think there's really any independence issue. I mean, yes, the Fed is working closely with the U.S. Treasury, but the goals are aligned, and it's not controversial. I mean, Democrats and Republicans both support what the Fed is doing. So, at the end of the day, people can overstate the degree of independence that the Federal Reserve has. I mean, independence is not really about what goals the central bank should pursue. Those goals of full employment and price stability are set by Congress. The independence is really more about tactics, how the Fed goes about achieving those goals. The independence idea is a little bit overstated. But I do agree that down the road, there could be a conflict between what's good for monetary policy and keeping inflation in check and what's good for fiscal policy. You look at what happened after World War II, Fed had put caps on long-term interest rates, and that started to generate some upward pressure on inflation. The Fed negotiated with the Treasury the end of the Treasury-Fed Accord in the early 1950s, but the Fed was slow to respond to the inflation pressures that began to develop in the 1960s and early 1970s. So, I don't know if that was an independence of monetary policy issue or not, but you can certainly imagine that there was going to be a tension at some point, potentially. Whenever you have a large accumulated overhang of debt, there's always pressure and incentives to inflate away the debt. And so I think that will arrive at some point down the road.
How do you feel about U.S. oversight of non-banks and market-based finance? So the central banks of the world have done a good job with Basel III, I think, in strengthening the banking system. But the non-banks, market-based finance is more in the realm of the FSOC and the SEC. They've adopted an activities-based approach. They don't act as systemic and prudential regulators, the best I can see. And I frankly don't even know how they would implement an activities framework other than telling me that that's the way they do it. There's a huge leverage in the system in the U.S. There are proposals about equalizing treatment of debt and equity. There's proposals about gates and fees and all that. But the Fed has responsibility for financial stability. And you could easily have problems in the non-bank sector that cause problems for economy and financial stability. And yet the Fed, it seems to me, is relatively quiet about this area. Certainly, they don't propose options on how to tackle the situation in its financial stability reports. I was wondering how you see this. Does the Fed need to be more outspoken and activist on this front?
I think so, because the reality is, as you say, the banking sector seems to be well regulated, a lot more capital, a lot more liquidity, very solid. The non-bank financial sector still seems to be underregulated from a financial stability perspective. And we see a number of cases where, you know, that the non-bank sector got, you know, was over its skis in March when the pandemic started to become you know, really a significant issue for markets. So the Fed had to intervene in the treasury market to basically enable hedge funds to get out of highly leveraged trades where they were long cash treasuries and short futures. Fed intervened to support the corporate debt markets to basically restore market functioning in those markets. And Fed intervened to support the mortgage-backed securities market because there was also quite a bit of stress there. You know, the problem is that the Fed doesn't regulate the amount of leverage in those market segments. And there's also a problem that people basically invest in assets and they think they have overnight liquidity. But those assets, if they're highly illiquid, really can't really be managed to that kind of mandate. So I think there's a real issue for the non-bank financial sector, how we're going to actually regulate. What you don't want to have a situation is where people can do whatever they want, and then there's a problem, and the Fed comes in and sort of bails them out, because that sends a message that, okay, you don't have to absorb the tail risk. The Fed is absorbing the tail risk. The U.S. government is absorbing the tail risk. That encourages those entities to take more risk in the future. Now, I think if a financial crisis happened once every 50 years, this moral hazard problem wouldn't be very significant because, you know, no one would remember the potential for bailouts. But when we have something like this happening, you know, every 10 years or so, then I think it starts to become potentially systemic. People say, gee, the Fed's always going to ride to the rescue. Therefore, I can take more risk. Therefore, the Fed has to ride to the rescue next time. And then the situation becomes more and more acute. So I think this is something the Fed does need to talk about. And I think there's a number of things that could be done. I mean, for example, a very simple thing that could be done is basically tell people that if you invest in mutual funds that hold highly illiquid assets, you don't get overnight liquidity. You just don't. You get monthly liquidity. And if you don't want to hold the asset because you have monthly liquidity, you probably shouldn't be in that asset class to start with. So that's something that you could do very simply that I don't think would be, you know, greatly disadvantaged to investors. In fact, it might actually put investors on notice that the asset class that you're holding actually has some risk associated with. Another thing I think they need to do is think about how can we make people pay for liquidity insurance ex ante during peacetime. So all those hedge funds that were, you know, levered 50, 60, 70 to 1, how do you make them get some sort of liquidity insurance ex ante during peacetime so that they bear some of the cost of the leverage that they're taking on? So I think these are things that need to be explored, and I think the Fed will be talking about them as we go forward.
I think that personally that the United States needs more and better macroprudential oversight. You mentioned that the Fed had done the swaps and there was the repo facility as well. You know, I remember eons ago, Greenspan used to say that they take the international context into account insofar as it impacts the optimal functioning of the U.S. economy. It seems as if in recent decades, the financial channel has become a much more prominent vehicle for impacts. I was wondering, based on your experience and history, there's no global lender of last resort, save the Fed, perhaps reluctantly. What do you think about the international mindedness of the Fed? Is it perfect or does it need to be more so?
I mean, I think the Fed certainly takes the international outlook into consideration, but at the end of the day, their mandate is about U.S. full employment, U.S. price stability, so that can only go so far. So when the Fed convenes and basically offers these foreign exchange swap facilities that auction money in, you know, ECB and Switzerland and UK and Japan, et cetera, they're doing that not because they're trying to support the international economy, but because they're trying to support the U.S. economy, because those banking organizations have, you know, dollar-based assets that they need to fund in international financial markets. And if that funding mechanism breaks down, which it basically was breaking down in March, the Fed wants to run right to the rescue, not because it helps the international economy so much, because it actually helps support the U.S. economy. So the Fed is basically essentially providing a backstop for the dollar, which is a reserve currency. And I think by providing that backstop, that probably reinforces, you know, the attractiveness of the dollar as a reserve currency, and that's probably in the U.S. interest.
Well, great. Let me turn to Tamer Beg.
Thanks, Mark. Bill Dudley, thank you very much. But I want to stay on that international aspect and from the point that you made that the Fed will do things, even at the international arena, that sort of serves the U.S. full employment and price stability objective. Now, I'm sure you know that in the markets, there's a big narrative of the pivot of the dollar toward a weakening trend, something that would be very much in the interest of the Fed from an easing of financial conditions perspective. And of course, the swap facilities and even the FEMA facility helped that because we saw a soaring of the dollar in the really bad days of the pandemic-related panic. And after that, as the liquidity conditions improved, the dollar also sort of, you know, weakened. Could the toolbox be expanded? You know, the swap was popular. It's getting unwound. FEMA was a bit expensive. Could the Fed expand the swap facilities to a larger number of countries, to the ones actually who really need it, as opposed to Bank of Japan, which probably needed it temporarily for Japanese corporates, but it doesn't really need that. And secondly, along the same lines of sort of, you know, helping monetary conditions worldwide and by extension helping the Fed, could the Fed expand asset purchase to buying investment grade emerging market bonds? Second question is more of a crystal ball gazing one, which is when we look at the experience post the Spanish influenza pandemic, and I see a big divergence in economic performance of the UK versus the US. UK was obsessed with going back to the gold standard and, you know, focusing on austerity, and as a result, you know, suffered tremendously. And the 1920s was basically a lost decade for the UK. US was all about globalization in those days, exporter of textile and capital around the world. And of course, US had a fantastic 20s. The UK experience, does that tell us that going forward, more than financing, what we probably need is debt forgiveness?
So in terms of the swaps, it's very unlikely the Fed is going to be willing to expand the swap networks beyond what they've done. I mean, swaps are basically about private banks financing dollar-denominated assets, not about countries that are suffering capital flight reversals out of their countries and therefore having balance of payments problems. So the Fed basically doesn't view that as in their remit. So the swaps programs have typically been confined to large countries that are highly creditworthy and major financial centers, and the Fed has been very reluctant to go beyond that. So, for example, recently Turkey has been, you know, asking the U.S. for a foreign exchange swap program, and the U.S. has declined, and that just is an example of where that bright line is. In terms of emerging market debt purchases, I think that's highly unlikely. I mean, the Fed, in principle, is allowed to buy foreign sovereign debt, but they never have done that because it just raises this whole question of, like, why are you buying that country's debt versus some other country's debt? And it also could be seen as a device to deliberately, you know, try to weaken the U.S. dollar. So Fed has the authority, but they've never done it. To buy emerging market debt, you know, if it's non-governmental debt, I would have to do it under Section 13.3. I don't understand how they could possibly, you know, justify it under Section 13.3. That's basically a provision of the Federal Reserve Act that says that a borrower can obtain credit under unusual exigent circumstances and with agreement of the U.S. Treasury. Fed can basically come in and provide support. And I just don't see how emerging market debt would qualify under provisions of Section 13.3. So I think that's highly unlikely. So I think the swap programs are basically going to continue as they are right now. They'll have weekly auctions in place, and they'll be used to the extent that there's market strain. And if there's not market strain, the outstanding balances will be paid down. And what we see right now is there being the 84-day maturities are starting to mature. We're seeing those outstanding balances are being paid down. In terms of, you know, the debt forgiveness issue, I think there's a huge issue in terms of emerging market debt that we are going to see over the next 6 months caused by capital flow reversals and just the huge downshift in terms of global economic activity and downward pressure on commodity prices. So I think there's going to be a very tough environment for emerging market economies, and that's going to create a lot of strain, but that's not in the Fed's purview. That's really something that, you know, Congress, the administration, the IMF, the World Bank, you know, take up. I think that, you know, debt forgiveness may be, you know, an issue that's going to be on the table. It's also really important to bring the Chinese government along. China has a lot of debt of its own outstanding to emerging market economies. So there needs to be sort of a coordinated solution. I think it's probably needed, but whether it's actually going to be forthcoming in a timely way, I think that remains, in my mind, very highly uncertain.
Well, thank you for that. We will wind this down. I just would say that the reason the Fed had so much on the shelf is very much to your successful tenure and reign at the New York Fed, both on the desk and as president. We thank you for all of your service. I thank you for joining us today for a fantastic presentation. Thank you, Bill Dudley.
Thank you, Mark. A pleasure.
Thank you.